Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I just want to ask people to like and subscribe to our channel. We're on our video channels on YouTube, but we're also on Odyssey now. So I just ask if you want to subscribe there as well. That would be great. Or if you prefer to use that rather than YouTube and big tech, that'd be great. Obviously, subscribe on your local podcast generator as well. And we really appreciate that. And it helps other people find out about it. We've been growing pretty well, and I want to just keep that up. Okay, today's guest is Dr. Eduardo Echevarria, and he is a professor of philosophy and systematic theology at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit. He earned his doctorate in philosophy from the Free University in Amsterdam and his STL from the University of St. Thomas Aquinas, the Angelicum, in Rome. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and what we want to talk about today is going to be a little bit different than our normal interview podcast. Actually, Ed reached out to me about the idea for this, and I thought it was a great idea. My book, you know, Deadly Indifference, which came out a few months ago, I recommend it highly. It is about the rise of religious indifference in the Catholic Church over the past maybe 60 years or so, and also the role of ecumenism, interreligious dialogue in that, how popes such as John Paul II, how they have impacted that. And this is something of interest to Dr. Echevarria as well. And he and I have similar but not identical views on this. And so we thought it'd be good to flesh out a lot of this topic. So hopefully it'll help people understand it a little bit better. So I think what I want to start with is simply how would you define the problem of religious indifference in the church, and kind of how would you define it and what's its source?
Well, we could first, if we consider religious indifference with respect to ecumenism, I would say that that occurs in many places, but it occurs in particular when someone subscribes to an ecclesiological relativism. That is, that there are many churches. The way I set that up is to say, look, Vatican II, Lumen Gentium, reaffirms the historic teaching of the church. That is, the church that Christ founded subsists in its own right in the Catholic Church. It doesn't subsist anywhere else. However, it doesn't draw the conclusion from that, that therefore outside the visible boundaries of the church, all you have is a wasteland, an ecclesial wasteland or emptiness. It explicitly says, that in Lumen Gentium 8, that outside the visible boundaries of the church, there exist elements of truth and sanctification, and that those elements do not exist in an ecclesial vacuum, but that in some sense, they are ecclesially embodied. So you have ecclesial communities. One might even argue, you know, a church with a small c. On the other hand, the other dilemma is that once people began to recognize that there are elements of truth and sanctification outside the visible boundaries of the church, that outside those boundaries, you don't have a wasteland or emptiness. The decree in ecumenism makes that very explicit in paragraph 4 about, there are writings, teachings, etc., outside the visible boundaries of the church that can enrich the Christian life, bring about even a fuller realization of the Catholic life. For instance, in paragraph 17 of the decree in ecumenism, Unitatis Ret Integratio, it makes a distinction between doctrinal truths and their foundations. And it says, then it's not surprising if one tradition, it's talking about the Orthodox, but I've in my writings, I've applied that to the tradition that I know the best, the Reformed tradition, and in particular, Dutch Neo-Calvinism of Kuyper and Bavinck and Berkhouwer and many others, it's not surprising, it says there, that if one tradition or another has a much deeper appreciation of some aspect of the revealed mystery. So one example of that is the public theologian, prolific scholar of the late 19th, early 20th century, Abraham Kuyper, also the founder of the Free University, where I received my doctorate. He has among his many writings, he has a three-volume work on the Lordship of Christ. And I say, yes, we have a solemnity that we recently celebrated on the Lordship of Christ. But I think the Reformed tradition, in particular the work of Kuyper, has a much deeper appreciation of Christ's Lordship. It's not, we of course confess the Lordship of Christ like they do. But I think they have a much deeper appreciation of the Lordship of Christ over every area of human life. They have a more articulate theology. And Lumen the Decree on Ecumenism, paragraph 17, says that so long as that alternative formulation is compatible and doesn't conflict with Catholic theology, the Catholic theology of Christ's Lordship, it can deepen our understanding of the Catholic theology of Christ's Lordship. So on the one hand, we must avoid drawing the conclusion, because Lumen Gentium 8 continues to teach, and so does the Decree on Ecumenism, and so does John Paul II's Ut Unum Sint, continues to teach. There's no change there. There's a development, but there's no change there. Continues to teach that the church that Christ founded subsists in its own, therefore outside the visible boundary of the church, all you have is a wasteland or emptiness. There are these elements of truth and sanctification outside the visible boundary of the church. There are these gifts. I would consider Kuyper's theology of the Lordship of Christ a gift to the church, because it deepens our understanding of Christ's Lordship. The other dilemma to avoid is the idea that if there are these elements of truth and sanctification, some people have then drawn the conclusion that therefore the church now embraces ecclesial relativism, so that there are many churches, or that it embraces some version of the branch theory of Christianity, where the trunk is Christianity, and then you have all these varied branches of Presbyterianism or Lutheranism, and Catholicism maybe being a big branch. No, on this matter, I say, Pius XI's Mortalium Animus, which rejected ecumenism, and the Decree on Ecumenism of Vatican II, everything that Pius rejected, such as the branch theory of Christianity, such as ecclesiological relativism, such as religious indifferentism, which would follow from that, is rejected by Vatican II, rejected by Unitatis Rede Integratio, rejected even by the Declaration on Religious Liberty, rejected by John Paul II. So to me, that's the dilemma one has to avoid. And I think... Here's even a more basic point, and that is ecclesial diversity and hoping to somehow arrive at unity out of diversity. No, the church already exists as one. There is only one church. The church already exists as one, but in the context of that dilemma that I sketch, we still have to consider, because the church affirms ecumenism, separated brethren, we're brothers and sisters in Christ, and so on. The church that has to go on to think about ecclesial unity and diversity within the one church, and the one church is Catholicism. The one church is the Catholic Church. And so in that context, I would say it's very clear that... ecumenism is not about generating unity from diversity. Unfortunately, in my view, you get this idea that somehow you're trying to generate unity out of diversity. That's not Catholic ecumenism.
Right.
Catholic ecumenism begins with a commitment to Already the church is one. The church exists as one, the unity of the church. And then from out of that, the question about ecumenical relations arises. And of course, ecumenical relations is vastly different than the question of interreligious relations or interreligious dialogue. Right. That would be my initial.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask about this, you mentioned about the fact that, of course, Vatican II says that there's elements of truth outside of our ecclesial visible bounds. And absolutely. But it seems to me that particularly before Vatican II, that was never rejected in the sense that, of course, like, for example, one of the problems with heresies is that they take a truth and they go too extreme on that and they don't like get the fullness of it. So, for example, Arianism, yes, Jesus is a man, but they, of course, went the whole way and said he was just a creature, wasn't God. And you could think of, you know, Luther, of course, did the same thing with a lot of things. And many heretics, that's what they do, is they take a truth and they go too far. So, for example, with the Reformed tradition and the Lordship of Jesus Christ, yes, that's obviously true, but the danger is that they've often taken that to extreme. Like, I know a lot of, Reformed people, friends, who they take that Lordship of Christ to the point of a very strict predestination, double predestination, the idea that God predestines people for hell because he is, you know, above all things, Lord, and almost take away free will. They take away the idea of free will, and so they take this idea of the Lordship of Christ to an extreme. And it seems like before Vatican II, there was that recognition by the church that, okay, it's not saying every single thing they say is wrong and false, but it's dangerous because they've gone too far in one direction. And now with the emphasis on, okay, let's just look at the fact that they have certain truth claims, to me that seems like a dangerous practical matter. It's not necessarily theologically that it's wrong, because obviously it's true that non-Catholic Christians if they think Jesus Christ is God, then obviously that's true. But there's danger in affirming that too enthusiastically and focusing on that without focusing in balance on, but they take it also too far in some ways and they fall into error by doing that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But yes, of course. But in a sense, I would say the same thing about, if you consider, I mentioned Pius XI's Mortalium Animus and Vatican II's Unitatis Redi Integratio, I would argue that everything that Pius rejected, those ecclesial relativism, the branch theory of Christianity, religious indifferentism, and so on, I think Vatican II rejects that. The only thing is that I think Pius didn't ask the question, what is ecumenism? What is ecumenism? You have to look at it in its historical context. And it's in historical context, of course, the understanding of ecumenism seemed to entail all these elements that were rejected by Pius XI. So it seems to me, having rejected all those things, and Vatican II agrees with all those things that was rejected, Vatican II did something and people like Yves Congar and others, they asked the question, well, what is ecumenism? How do we make sense of, John 17, that they all may be one, ut unum sint, as John Paul II's encyclical is called. In what sense can we say that we're brethren in Christ, even if separated brethren? So I would say, yes, there's a kind of a narrowness, a one-sidedness, let's call it, even on the part of the church, because even on the part of Pius, because he didn't ask the question, well, what is ecumenism? How do we understand our relationship with non-Catholics, not non-Christian, but non-Catholics? So, it's not, to me, it's not a shift. To me, That's the term that you use, isn't that right? Shift.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, emphasis shift. Yeah.
Right. And also, I don't agree I'm unique to one among many. Well, of course, there is ecclesial unity and diversity. But the question, it seemed to me, that the decree on ecumenism and John Paul II, we understand, and I've written about this, how do we understand unity and diversity within the one church? Ecclesial unity and diversity within the one church.
It just seems to...
Yeah. Just one, just if I may, just one more
thing,
and that is that Vatican II didn't change the church's ecclesiology. If change means that, and I mean change in the, I always go back to Vincent of Lorenz, John the 23rd cites Vincent of Lorenz in his opening address. He's citing Vatican I, and Vatican I is citing Vincent of Lorenz from his Communitorium, where Vincent asks the question, is there no progress, is there no development in religion, he means. And he makes a distinction between progress and change. Change is when one thing becomes something else. If the church had embraced at Vatican II ecclesiological relativism, there would have been a change. Then, yes, indeed, then the church would have, its ecclesiology would have been now different. But there, I don't believe there was a change. I think there was a development.
And I think my major point, what I'm trying to say, the emphasis shift, is I purposely didn't use the word change. Because what I'm saying is that, like, for just use example I just mentioned before, is there's an emphasis shift before the church was mainly focused on the errors of non-Catholic religions. So the errors of Protestantism, and then when you go interreligious dialogue, which I know is different, but like errors of other religions, even the errors within Orthodoxy, although that, you know, is a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. But really the focus, like for example, with the Protestants, was the errors that they held to. But then that was the emphasis. The emphasis since Vatican II has clearly, in my mind, shifted to the focus on the truth, the claims of truth that Protestants do hold, because obviously they do have certain things that are true in what they believe. And to me, that it's not a matter of, like, one of the things I'm trying to make the point of is, it seems to me almost not, almost a argument that distracts us to talk about whether or not Vatican II change something. I basically agree with you, by the way, that I don't think Vatican II changed Catholic doctrine in any way. But I do think that, and I don't think it's all Vatican II. I think it's like the way the church was shifting at that time. I mean, like I mentioned, Pope Paul VI had an encyclical that I think was very influential that came out during Vatican II, but it wasn't part of Vatican II. But I think what happens is you see this radical, I think, I would call it radical, shift between before. I mean, even John the 23rd himself didn't allow really ecumenical work, but done by Catholics. I mean, there's a little bit of a softening there, but not really much. And then all of a sudden, after Vatican II, under Paul VI, you see a huge increase of ecumenical activity. That alone, to me, is a shift. Now, is it a development? And if it's, you know, doctrinally and all that, but I think practically there's no question in my mind, it everything is different afterwards as far as how the church approached the Protestant religions and the Protestant.
Okay, here's where I would say the question, I don't think that it's merely that Vatican II began to focus on, you know, a sort of a common denominator that of truths that Catholics and Protestants held. I think it was, that's why I mentioned Lumen Gentium, not Lumen Gentium, but Unitatis Rite Integratio, paragraph 17. I think the church developed what later began to be called receptive ecumenism. And that means, as I said a moment ago, that the at one level, the focus was on and saying it differently, deepening our understanding of those truths that we shared, so that it's not just that the church now came to recognize that Lutherans or Reformed or Presbyterians, etc., that for instance, all of Lutherans, Reformed, and Presbyterians all hold that the sacraments are means of grace. They're not Zwinglians. They don't think that the sacraments are just empty and outward signs. No, even Calvin thought that the sacramental signs signify that the bread and wine are divinely established signs signifying the body and blood of Christ. And so, if you read the confessions and creeds of those traditions, whether it's the Second Helvetic Confession or the Westminster Confession of Faith, you see that when it comes to the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper, they also think that those signs are divinely established, and that they signify the body and blood of Christ. Now, so my point is that it's not just that in ecumenical relations the church now began to emphasize. To me, that wasn't the shift. That now that they also held theologically true statements. No, I think they began to recognize a receptive ecumenism, such that, as John Paul II says, that ecumenism is not just an exchange of ideas, but it's actually an exchange of gifts. And it's an exchange of gifts, not at the level that, if I stick with my example of Kuyper, not because Kuyper was telling us something that we didn't affirm as Catholics, we affirmed the Lordship of Christ, but it's that Kuyper's theology of Christ's Lordship was deepening our understanding of Christ's Lordship, such that we can now say, with respect to many things, they're saying the same thing, but in a different way. And then the question is what is the manner in which they're saying this? Is it deepening our understanding of these truths? Are we now able to bring about, again, in paragraph 17, as it says, it brings about a fuller realization of the Catholicity of the Christian faith. In my view, yes, of course, you can't work with receptive ecumenism entirely, because at some point in ecumenical discussion, you can shift to ecumenical apologetics. Because the fact is, they're not saying the same. It's not that everything that they're saying, it's not that they're saying the same thing with respect to everything. Sometimes they're saying something different. And with respect regarding the papacy, and even with respect to the sacraments, even though we can find, I think, that they can deepen our understanding of the sacraments. And again, Reformed, Lutherans, and Catholics stand on one side, because they all think that the sacraments are means of grace, and even that they're efficacious means of grace. Whereas a Baptist is a Zwinglian, and he thinks that the sacrament is only efficacious in faith and so on. So it seems to me that one can deepen one's understanding of the Catholic faith by engaging ecumenically with these other Christians. They're not, Protestantism is not, it's not another religion. You know, if you're Reformed, that's not another religion. Baptist, not another religion. Another religion would be Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism. But these are, the church says that they're separated brethren. I see no reason.
But they are heretical. I mean, I'm not saying they're heretics. That's a different definition. But they definitely accept heresy, and heresy that could, because, I mean, so much so that they don't have a valid Eucharist. You know, we both know that.
Yeah, and, that's true. Between being a heretic in a formal sense from being a material heretic.
Right. Yeah. I'm talking about the fact is, though, they because they believe heresy, it I mean, traditionally the church would always say that that puts their salvation in real jeopardy. It's not just a minor thing. So yes, while they're not a different religion, agreed. I mean, obviously they're a Christian religion. We're not talking about the Mormons even. We're talking right. about Protestants who have a valid baptism and obviously the Orthodox.
Right, exactly.
But the fact that
there's grace. I mean, already in the 18th century, you know, the church rejected the idea that there isn't grace outside the visible boundaries of the church.
Right. So but at the same time, the heresy is very dangerous. I mean, they accept heresy explicitly. Now, again, there's a whole point of like, I assume you grew up. What did you grow up? Were you Reformed?
No, I grew up Catholic, but it was in an evangelical Protestant context at La Brie Fellowship in Switzerland that I committed my life to Christ. And then over time, you know, evangelical Protestantism, the Reformed tradition, Anglo-Catholicism, and then so that was in 1970. And then in 1992, I went ahead into the Catholic Church.
Okay. Yeah. So I grew up Protestant. And so like, you know, my family's still Protestant. And so like, I understand that there's a whole mitigating factors of, about how much they, you know, what they know and right. you know, all that kid honestly, that's for God to work all that out. Fortunately, not for us. But as Catholics, we know that and I've seen this, you know, definitely that they don't receive the graces that we do. I mean, I'm not saying they don't receive grace, but the fact is, we receive through the sacraments, through the valid sacraments of the Catholic Church, we receive sacraments. Sure. And I feel like personally, without those, I'm like in big trouble. And so it's hard not to say. And so like there's this focus on, yes, they do have grace. Yes, they do have teachings that are true, but shouldn't our emphasis be on the idea that their souls are in jeopardy because of the fact that they don't have the fullness of the truth. They don't have valid sacraments, most importantly, other, you know, baptism, not talking about that, but, you know, like the Eucharist. I mean, our Lord said, unless you eat this bread, you know, eat my flesh and drink my blood, you will not have eternal life. So I just feel like those are the things that are lost today through this emphasis in ecumenical work on this focus on saying these things that are true about Protestantism. And I'm not denying that they're true. I'm just saying that we're forgetting, at least on a corporate level, it seems that we're forgetting, because your average Catholic in the pew, he actually thinks, this is my experience, and poll numbers show us that he actually thinks that not only does Protestantism save through the practice of Protestantism, but even Islam or
well, yeah, no, that's
whatever.
And, yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree that that's just mistaken. I wrote an article, I don't know if I sent that to you, where, you know, I objected to the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, that it would send out greetings for, you know, non-Christian holy days. It seems to me that seemed to suggest that somehow their practices were efficacious means of grace and all that. So I think that that indeed does foster a kind of religious indifference.
Likewise, like the Vatican noting Reformation Day most years. I think that's similar in that we shouldn't be celebrating Reformation Day any way.
No, of course that, but that's, I mean, I honestly, I've written about that in my Francis book, even the second edition. No, it just seems to me that that's just, a confusion on the part of Pope Francis that he, but I think that has everything to do with the fact that he's not clear on the starting point of Catholic ecumenism. I think he just accepts ecclesial diversity as a starting point, and he hopes to generate a unity out of that. Right. And even with, but here's another thing. I think in Francis's case, I think it has to do with there are several places where it's a denial of what propositional truth. In other words, I think he thinks that, if we're talking about interreligious dialogue now, yes, of course, he says we have to affirm what is unique to the Catholic faith, an interreligious dialogue, but then he doesn't want to consider the fact that there's a conflict, a incompatibility, a logical incompatibility between the truth claims of Christianity and Islam, for instance. If Christianity is true, then Islam can't be true.
Right.
So that means that, there's a place where since you mentioned, the 1997 document, Dialogue and Proclamation, it says that an open and positive approach to other religious traditions cannot overlook the contradictions that may exist between them and Christian revelation. It must, where necessary, recognize that there is incompatibility between some fundamental elements of the Christian religion and some aspects of such traditions. And even...
But you almost never see that practiced.
Course. And you never see that. And of course, in the context of Francis, that's never discussed. And right. Just one other thing here. I mean, I think I've often cited this passage where Francis says it's mind-boggling, but he says to dialogue with other religions, he says, means to believe that the other has something worthwhile to say and to entertain his or her point of view and perspective. Engaging in dialogue, he says, does not mean renouncing our own ideas and traditions, but, and this is astounding to me that he could actually say this, this tells me he doesn't understand, but the renouncing of the claim that they alone are valid or absolute. So in other words, there he suggests that he wants to withdraw the validity or absoluteness of Christian beliefs. He says it again elsewhere. To dialogue means, not denying the uniqueness of our own standpoint and blah, blah, blah. But it does mean that we have to renounce the claim that they alone are valid or absolute. So again, it seems to me he doesn't seem to understand. He doesn't seem to understand that if Christianity is true, with respect to the central claims of Christianity, you can have a conversation with a Muslim and, they have a theology of creation. They're monotheist. But even if you begin to probe their monotheism, they're Unitarians. Even though they confess that there's one God, when you probe their understanding of oneness, of course, it's incompatible with Trinitarianism of Christianity, because they can't understand unity and diversity in the Godhead. So yes, you can find points of agreement, and you can even find moral truths. St. Paul says in Romans 2 verses 14 and following. But the fact is, and I agree, I mean, one has to say that very clearly, that if Christianity is true, then Islam can't be true, because Islam denies the incarnation,
right?
It denies the atoning work of Christ, it denies the resurrection, it denies the ascension, et cetera, et cetera. We can't possibly think that those matters are just sort of extra added matters, So yeah. I would say that... I think John Paul II understood that, because his understanding of dialogue was dialogue is truth oriented, and the same thing with Benedict. Dialogue was truth oriented, whereas in the case of Francis, I don't think that's the case. I don't think he understands that. I don't think he understands that there are these conflicting, incompatible beliefs, and so that you need to take that seriously if you're going to have a conversation. The document on dialogue and proclamation, I don't think it affirms the priority of dialogue. I think it affirms the priority of proclamation, just as
I want to talk a little bit about this idea of dialogue, though, because when I was researching for my book, the fact is that the idea of dialogue as a methodology, I guess you would call it, or even in some, although I think in some minds it's become a goal, is dialogue, not a methodology, which is obviously wrong. But as a methodology, you see that really Pope Paul VI introduces it in 1964, I believe it is. I'm blanking on the encyclical name.
In Ecclesia Suum, yes.
Thank you. I should remember that, but I didn't. And the truth is, and he talks about, though, like dialogue is has always been the way the church does things. And if you look, I can't read church history myself and see dialogue as it's defined in the modern man world as something that the church ever engaged in, really. Yes, I do understand that missionaries would go to other places and they would try to find ways to communicate with the people. And sometimes that means understanding their culture, things like that. But St. Boniface is cutting down the tree. He's not dialoguing with the worshipers of Thor. And so to me, it seems like even the assumption that the church makes now of proclamation dialogue, even the assumption that dialogue is even a viable methodology in church, to me, I think that's not true. I think that dialogue itself, as the modern mind defines dialogue, simply isn't part of the church's mission. It's proclamation, period.
Well, you could have, I would say, you could distinguish, you can say that dialogue has to do with pre-evangelization. Okay. But historically, of course, I think you're entirely right. I mean, the idea that somehow the church has been engaged in dialogue throughout its history, at least the way we understand dialogue now, is undoubtedly not the case. But we could see dialogue as pre-evangelization. So there's no reason why we can't ascribe a significant place to dialogue. I mean, it's like, you could
in
say
practice, we never get to the evangelization. Dialogue. Yeah, but it's like it's pre-evangelization. But like I was going to say, it's pre-evangelization, and I can grant that. But in practice, we never take the step to actual evangelization. When I say we, I mean the church as a whole. Yeah.
But you know what? I think that has to do with other presuppositions that people operate under. One of them being that the rejection of propositional truth, the idea that the rejection of the idea that that you have to make a distinction between Benedict says this, that at some point you have to provide a justification of why you're a Christian and not a Muslim. At some point you have to say, he says, I'm a Christian and I'm not a Muslim, and this is the reason why. And of course, with respect to the central claims of Christianity, the falsehood of Islam is going to be entailed by the truth of the central claims of Christianity. So we live in a culture, of course, which has been infected by a kind of relativism, where people are afraid to say, here, if P is true, then not P must be false.
Right.
And hence, anyone who holds not P must be wrong, you see. It's not just that there are differences. It's that the person who holds not P must be wrong. So I think people are afraid to say that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, that's true, period. That Jesus Christ died for our sins, that's true, period. People are afraid to say, if you don't think that there are true propositions, well, then there are no false ones either.
Right.
And hence, there are only differences, and nobody's wrong.
Right.
And that's where we are as a culture, you see.
And that's so you can have endless dialogue if that's the case.
Right. Well, and see, that's right. And then, that's why I say, for John Paul, for Benedict, dialogue was truth-oriented. In that 1997 Christianity and World Religions, it says, from the International Theological Commission, it says, it is clear that the discussion about the truth claim of the religions cannot be a marginal or partial aspect of theology. The respectful confrontation with this truth claim must play a role in the center of the daily work of theology. It must be an integral part of it. And you know, if you know from Ratzinger's Truth and Tolerance, I mean, at the very center of that book, at the reason for writing that book, or what generates the discussion, is precisely because he thinks that, and what generates the discussion about evangelism is precisely because Christianity is true. So it seems to me, if one doesn't say that, then of course that contributes to this indifferentism.
Right, right.
And I never hear that from Francis.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. I hear that plentifully from John Paul II, from, you know, Veritatis Splendor, and from Fides et Ratio, and many of his other. I mean, he got into trouble crossing the threshold of hope. He was very critical of Islam, the chapter on Islam. And he was told when he was going to Indonesia that before he was allowed to enter into Indonesia, he had to apologize for having written that chapter, because he was very critical of the Islamic religion. But so it seems to me that there are all these other assumptions that there's no propositional truth, a kind of an anti-realism, a denial of objective truth, the idea that there are just differences. This is, you know, I wrote about this, Francis's Fratelli Tutti, you know. It just seems to me to be lost in not affirming the question of truth, and that... that a proposition is going to be true if what it asserts is in fact the case about objective reality. All of that is missing because he thinks that we have to withdraw our claims as Christians to having absolute truth claims, or the only valid truth claim. So it seems to me, what do you make of that if you think that if the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, or that Jesus Christ died for our sins, or any of those, or that, you know, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting men's sins. Are those true in an absolute sense? Are those the truths about reality? I always say, you know, one of the things I learned at La Brie in 1970, which I never heard, not because they didn't believe it, but the Marist brothers that I had as teachers at Mount St. Michael Academy in the Bronx, you know, I say to people, the only reason to be a Christian in the end is because it's true.
Right.
Please don't tell me that you're a Christian or a Catholic because that's the way you were raised. No, that's an interesting biographical fact. But why? What's the reason for your Christian commitment, your commitment to the Catholic faith? So all of that has, I think, the loss of that, that there are just differences and nobody's wrong because there are no true theological propositions and all of that. It seems to me one then breeds indifference,
right?
Indifference, you know.
Now, a few times you mentioned John Paul II, and I think John Paul II is a difficult nut to crack in this, when it comes to ecumenism, but particularly interreligious dialogue, because he clearly took the ball. It, from what I saw, Paul VI allowed interreligious dialogue, but he was a little bit, he didn't quite embrace it. I think it was just something too new for him, or I don't know why. He allowed it, but he didn't embrace it. John Paul II definitely embraced it. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, he talked all the time. And he has many, many cases where he is speaking to a non-Catholic group, like a Muslim group, and he says things, and he always talks in very positive terms about them. Like you mentioned, crossing the threshold of hope, and I acknowledge that, but the vast majority of times he's talking, he is talking to them about the commonalities and what's great about it. I understand diplomacy, but it seems to me that the successor of St. Peter, successor of the apostles, should at some point be saying, you guys, you know, Catholicism true, and you should consider becoming Catholic. But he never really does that. I mean, I know he, in his writings, I mean, it's clear he believes Catholicism is true. I'm not trying to deny that. But he doesn't go that step of saying, and so you need to become Catholic, Muslims, or whoever you are. And then, of course, we had the Assisi meeting, which, in my opinion, was a was a disastrous event. Now, I make it very clear in my book that I'm careful to distinguish between John Paul II's intentions and his own personal theology and what he thinks and the result. And I do think that JP II, his intentions, I think, were noble. I also think that his theology of understanding that we're not praying to the same God, we're not praying together, but we're...
It's multi-religious, not inter-religious.
Right, exactly. And I get all those distinctions. But I it seems to me, though, that the message it actually sends to the world is that all religions are equal. It puts the Pope and Catholicism on the same level.
I agree with you, and that's why in Ratzinger's discussion of that in Truth and Tolerance, he was definitely against any idea of interreligious prayer, right, and very, very skeptical about multi-religious prayer, because right, he understood that it gives the impression of all religions being the same and so on and so on.
And yet he still had an Assisi meeting himself. I mean, I remember reading that, the Truth and Tolerance, when I was doing research for the book, and I remember reading that thinking, yes, Ratzinger kind of gets it, at least on some level, as I would say. But yeah, he had, but that's a little bit, frankly, that's a little bit Benedict, where he believed something, but he wasn't always great at executing. He was a little weak, in my opinion. I think he was a little weak in actually making it happen.
Right. No, I agree with you. I love John Paul II. His work has been, I think his work is great in many areas, and including his anthropology and the theology of the body and his defense of, here you have development again, his defense of the validity of the sacrament of marriage because of sexual differentiation, that it's sexual differentiation, which is the fundamental prerequisite for the two to become one flesh, such that it's not love that makes the sacrament valid. It's both, the form, as it were, the words, I take you as my wife, I take you as my husband. Of course, we live in a culture where words don't mean anything on that score, because two men can talk about each other as husbands and two women as wives. But John Paul II says there, look, I take you as my wife, I take you as my husband. Sexual difference has to be the corresponding reality. Those words have to correspond to sexual differentiation, because it's only differentiation that brings about the unity, the two in one flesh unity. Now, it seems to me that I think the theology of the body, that work, which was later put into one volume, Man and Woman, He Created Them, The Theology of the Body, I think that advances our understanding, both anthropologically, because it affirms, as the Catechism says, that the body shares in the dignity of the image of God, but also in justifying the validity of the sacrament of marriage, there has to be this sexual difference. Now, that doesn't mean that, I don't agree with everything John Paul II did. I'm not sure, Assisi.
But wouldn't you say, though, that just the whole kind of ethos of the church when it comes to interreligious dialogue that began in the 1960s, really, particularly interreligious dialogue, and it kind of grew, it led to a practical indifference in the minds of most Catholics. So that even somebody like JP II, who is, brilliant, and understands, he understands imagery. He helped bring down communism and do so much. And he understands the importance of images of that. Yet he still, I don't think he ever acknowledged that Assisi was a really bad idea, or even like the imagery there is terrible. And not just Assisi, but like all of his work in interreligious dialogue, not all of it, but a large amount of his work in interreligious dialogue, just gave that impression to the average Catholic, including the average Catholic priest, that, we're all basically in it, this together.
I agree. I don't know why he did that. I mean, I think he wanted to affirm, what St. Paul says about so far as is possible, try to be at peace with all men. All of that, all of those things, those are well worth reflecting on and all of that. But I agree that once you have all these other presuppositions, which he rejected, you know, religious pluralism, you know, that issues about, like what Ratzinger discusses also in Truth and Tolerance, that all language about God is actually penultimate because it doesn't genuinely refer to God. It just refers to our experience of God. And hence, of course, you're back to denying that there's an incompatibility at the level of who God is, you see. All of that, all of these things, it seems to me, and they're all present in our culture, and it seems to me contributes to this indifference. But I don't, here's my main point here. I don't believe that these presuppositions are embedded in the documents of Vatican II. I don't believe Vatican II embraces a sort of an anti-realist view such that our language about God is always penultimate and never genuinely refers to God.
I think Vatican II does embrace some presuppositions about man that seem to be a bit too optimistic, I would put it, which is different what you're saying, but...
Yeah. No, and there's obviously, look, the documents of Vatican II are not perfect. They're not perfect, but that doesn't mean that they affirm, I don't think that they affirm anything that is untrue. They're not perfect. Just as, you know, after the Council of Chalcedon, the Chalcedonian Creed, there were councils that came after that, and because there was more reflection on the question of the humanity of Christ. Was it one will, two wills, intellect, all of these things? So you can have a further deepening in our understanding. And I think the same thing goes, in fact, Ratzinger himself says that, and you may have quoted that, but Ratzinger himself says that when he says that one of the problems with Nostra Aetate, he says, you know, this document, which was, you know, he thinks a great document, he says, you know, the problem with it is that it's too positive, he says.
Right.
It's too positive, he says. It's too positive. He goes, oh, yes, he says, this is on the 50th anniversary of the opening of Vatican II regarding the reception of Nostra Aetate. He says, in the process of active reception of Nostra Aetate, a weakness in this otherwise extraordinary text has gradually emerged. It speaks of religion solely in a positive way. And it disregards the sick and distorted forms of religion, which from the historical and theological viewpoints are of far-reaching importance. For this reason, the Christian faith from the outset adopted a critical stance toward religions, both internally and externally. And even in Introduction to Christianity, he says, anyone who sees in the religions of the world only a reprehensible superstition is wrong, he says. But also anyone who wants only to give a positive evaluation of all religions and who has suddenly forgotten the criticism of religions that has been burnt into our souls, not only by Feuerbach and Marx, but also by such great theologians as Karl Barth and Bonhoeffer, is equally wrong. Now, I think, in my view, Francis overlooks all those things.
Right.
But he particularly overlooks the matter of conflicting truth claims.
And I think when it, you know, obviously Vatican II would be a whole nother discussion that would be interesting. But I think that's a perfect example, though, of how a document doesn't have to say something untrue in order to be either, it could even be harmful, but even at the very least, you could say it might just not be something that's helpful. And that's kind of, I think, where we lose the debate. We want to have a debate about Vatican II that's either true and therefore completely useful and good, or it's false and heretical. But I always feel like there's a big middle ground there of it may not be false, but it doesn't necessarily mean it was helpful for us at the time. And it definitely doesn't necessarily mean it's helpful for us today. Because like you said, you know, councils, they declare things, but it's not like all of a sudden you just stop and then there's nothing after that.
You have to continue. So for instance, the question of there are many questions that are affirmed. There are many, I would say, the truths that are affirmed by Vatican II. Like, for instance, as I said earlier, the matter of, what's the relationship? Mortalium animus of Pius XI, where he rejects ecumenism and then Unitatis Rei Integratio. Well, Unitatis Rei Integratio doesn't work out the coherence between those two documents and where they differ. These documents were not, in that sense, they weren't scholarly works. Right. So the attempt to show, and as I say, I've tried to do that elsewhere, the attempt to show that really there is an underlying continuity, even if development, not change, even if development with respect to those two documents, such that you can't simply say that there's a contradiction. You see, it seems to me neo-traditionalists, it seems to me, have the same view of Vatican II that liberal Catholics have. And that is that they think that there's a rupture. So, and then they want to say, well, mortalium animus, that's what's normative. And Unitatis Rei Integratio and Ut Unum Sint, we don't accept that. Whereas, of course, the Catholic liberal says, no, we accept Unitatis Rei Integratio, so Ut Unum Sint, but we think that those documents actually break or rupture with the preceding tradition.
I do think there's another position, though. And
yeah, there is another position.
I would not just in the middle. Like, I would say there was a rupture, but a rupture in practice. That's what I've been trying. That's what I try to say in the book, is that there's clearly a rupture in practice. How Catholics lived out their faith before Vatican II is clearly different than how they've lived it out afterwards. Right. And I don't think you can just let Vatican II off the hook as like have nothing to do with that. I also don't think you can dump it all on Vatican II itself either. Mm-hmm. But I would even go so far as to say the documents of Vatican II themselves have at least some connection, not just the event of Vatican II, which of course, as we know, the documents and there's the event, which is a whole another right. thing, a bigger thing, but I would say you even going all the way to documents that had an impact on a rupture in practice. And to use your example of ecumenism, just the idea of before Vatican II, Catholics weren't allowed to be involved in ecumenical work, and afterwards it was encouraged. That's clearly a rupture in practice. Right. And then I would take it a step further that I would say that it seems in a lot of those cases, not all of them, but in a lot of them, the practical rupture was a bad thing. That it was, I do think there are cases in which, like, I love Dei Verbum, for example, and I think that some of the development with that is beautiful. And but the point is, I think this is and obviously we're getting near the end of the time I want to go, because I don't like more than an hour, but, and so maybe we'll come back to this at another time, another podcast. But I do think that, I personally feel like I can say there was a rupture, but I'm careful to say it was a rupture in practice rather than.
I agree with that, but the problem. Okay, so I agree. We agree on that. That is a rupture in practice, but but I think that rupture came about because of the way that it was received, the way that the Vatican II documents were received, and all of these presuppositions that I've been trying to mention there that contributed to the faulty reception of Vatican II documents, and hence to the, this rupture in practice, as if the church was saying, well, you can go and pray with your, I belong to evangelicals and Catholics together, and we begin our meetings by prayer. So praying with a Baptist or a Presbyterian is not the same thing. I wouldn't pray with a Muslim.
Right.
I have said Shiva with Jews because we were just praying the Psalms. And the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, So, but my point is that what you rightly referred to as the rupture in practice has to do, I think, with the reception of the documents.
And then the question becomes, though, why was it received like that? Because if we note, of course, the bishops who implemented it and therefore received to implement it were the same in general, were mostly the same bishops who were at Vatican II. And so why was it that
some of them were already liberals.
Right.
Some of them were already liberals. Some of them were already had rejected, even if they weren't, vocal about that. I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, of, the Archbishop, the Cardinal of the Netherlands that I knew. I didn't know him personally, but I know the Netherlands very well. And that is, in the Netherlands, for instance, right before Vatican II, this wasn't a consequence of Vatican II, but already before Vatican II, they thought that the church was going to abandon, celibacy.
Right.
A celibate priesthood. And so some of these priests were already sort of had girlfriends or were already thinking of this was going to happen. And so it didn't happen. And Pope Paul VI expressly refused to take that direction, wrote an encyclical on the question of celibacy. And in fact, I remember the Dutch cardinal, whose name escapes me at the moment, he went to see the Pope about this, and the Pope would not see him. He said, I will see you, but I'm not going to talk about the question of celibacy. The church's position on this is clear.
Right.
So
right.
I think some of these, there were all kinds of presuppositions, cultural and intellectual, that made the reception of Vatican II's a faulty reception. I mean, even the Dominicans in the Netherlands, they wanted to have a Skillebake and others. They wanted to have the Eucharist celebrated by the laity and blah blah blah, all of this stuff. So I think all of that was collapsing beforehand. Right.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're going to wrap it up because we're at an hour. Okay. I'd like to keep that, but okay. I think I'm going to have you back someday because I want to talk more about Vatican II and feel
okay,
like
you sure. Good.
But
good.
What? Why don't we just? I want to leave you though with a moment here. Just kind of, where do you think we should be going, particularly with ecumenism? What would be a proper way to move forward with something like ecumenism in the church?
Well, again, I at one level, I think receptive ecumenism is fundamentally important. And that is, I tell students that if you can't bring yourself to say, wow, I learned something from that Protestant or that Reformed theologian, or whether it's even Calvin or Berkhauer or Bavinck or Barth or some, I see that in the light of, the Decree on Ecumenism, paragraph 17, that they can contribute to it. They have a deeper appreciation of some aspect of that revealed mystery, which can contribute to a deepening of our understanding of the Catholic faith. And we can receive that as a gift. Now, obviously, I think ecumenical apologetics, Matthew Levering's book on the Assumption is both an exercise in receptive ecumenism, but also at one level, an exercise in ecumenical apologetics, because he knows, the Assumption is a dogma, it's an infallible dogma, no less, and so you have to be able to provide a defense of that.
Right.
So it seems to me both those must be aspects of ecumenical engagement. Huh?
Okay.
But you have to begin by listening to the other, to the non-Catholic Christian. Let him formulate his issue. It may deepen your understanding of his position. It may deepen your understanding of the obstacles to avoid, putting in the way of the non-Catholic from actually receiving some aspect of the revealed mystery as we've developed it as Catholics.
Right. Okay, well, I think we're going to end it there because we need
okay,
to.
Cool.
Real quick, I want to just tell our listeners and viewers, please consider donating to Crisis Magazine. Just go to crisismagazine.com/support, and we'd appreciate anything you could do to help us out. It helps us keep going, do podcasts like this, and obviously the magazine, everything else. We're completely 100% supported by your donations. Thank you again, Dr. Echevarria. We really appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Hopefully, I do think we want to have, I felt like we could go on for 5 hours, but I
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but we'll come back again.
Another All right, Eric. Good to see you. Good to
God
talk
bless
to you.
Okay, everybody. Until next time. God bless you. God be with you.